Listeners are advised such glory in this episode is a voice actor and not a real judge. This is not a real court and none of those mentioned are on trial. The scope and purpose of this episode is to create a more immersive listening experience through the events retold from the newspaper archives.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS the Lost Voices with me, William Hampson, and my co-host, Judge Gloria.
Mr. Hampson, please approach the bench.
Is it relevant to the matter at hand?
Did the accused put forward
in
a
this
defense?
Series, we re-examine HIV and AIDS-related crimes from the newspaper archives of the 80s, 90s and noughties.
Court rise!
Please be seated. Mr. Hampson, please step up to the podcast microphone. It is my understanding we are here today to hear various accounts from the newspaper archives relating to the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
That's right, my lord. I have been sifting through the British newspaper archives from the 1980s, 90s and noughties, and where, under this crime series category, such crimes perhaps only came about through an individual learning of their own HIV/AIDS diagnosis.
Mr. Hampson, I see from the file before me a newspaper article that you intend to rely on in your presentation of this case today.
That's right, my lord. This article highlights the case of 29-year-old Hugh Rees, a Cambridge Honours graduate, where the Birmingham Evening Mail on the 18th of September 1987 ran the headline, "Alert on AIDS Man in Court," where they report, "A confirmed AIDS virus carrier was ushered into a court in Wolverhampton today by policemen wearing white surgeon's outfits, complete with masks and gloves. Two other policemen dressed in sealed helmets and protective suits stood on either side of Hugh Mark Rees, 30, of Parkdale, Wolverhampton, when he appeared before a stipendary magistrate. Rees was committed to stand trial at Dudley Crown Court, charged with robbery, deception, possession of firearms, possession of drugs, and forging a doctor's prescription." Oh, my lord, even for 1987, these descriptions are a gross overreaction, but sadly not uncommon in reports such as this. Routes of transmission in regards to HIV and AIDS was widely known and understood in the UK off the back of America as early as 1982. I cannot help but feel, in this case, my lord, that the authorities to wear such clothing was solely for the purpose of humiliating Hugh and stigmatising him for his condition rather than the crimes he's alleged to have committed. However, my lord, in this article and the headline that we heard, this journalist seems entirely focused on Hugh's AIDS illness rather than reporting on the court proceedings, so it only leaves us to assume that Hugh is remanded in custody until the trial, which is reported 3 months later. Because on the 17th of December 1987, Stoke-on-Trent's Evening Sentinel runs the headline, "AIDS robber will die in jail." I won't read this article in fear of repeating myself, my lord, because given the next day, the 18th of December 1987, both the Western Daily Press and the national newspaper The Guardian report the sentencing in greater detail. The Western Daily Press, under the headline, "Cambridge Genius Doomed by AIDS," go on to report, "A brilliant Cambridge graduate dying of AIDS robbed a post office of more than £3,000 to buy a fatal overdose of heroin, a court heard yesterday. But Judge William Allardyce rejected Hugh Rees's claims that he wanted to commit suicide and jailed him for 7 years. Dr. Margaret Jones, medical officer at Winston Green Prison, Birmingham, told Stafford Crown Court, quote, "The development of the full-blown AIDS condition has begun. It is unlikely he will survive more than 2 or 3 years, or he could become acutely ill next week. In September, while in prison, he cut his wrist with a razor blade in a suicide attempt," end quote. The judge told Rees, age 29, a former public schoolboy who worked for the United Nations, quote, "Your situation in life is desperate, but I am far from convinced and reject the suggestion if necessary that this was part of a suicidal attempt. Someone of your intelligence, if you wanted to commit suicide, could have thought of a far more quicker way than wanting to go to London to buy heroin," end quote. Rees of Etting Hall, Wolverhampton, holder of a first-class honours degree in modern languages, admitted the robbery of £3,200. His not guilty plea to possessing a shotgun was accepted. Mr. Alastair McCreeve, prosecuting, said, quote, "Rees was gravely ill and the prosecution has reason to believe he wanted money to buy a powerful drug to do away with himself," end quote. He said Rees went into a post office in Chapel Ash, Wolverhampton, carrying a bag, quote, and pointed something at a woman behind the counter. She was convinced it was a gun, and she was of course terrified and handed over the money, end quote. Rees caught a train at Wolverhampton, but was spotted and the police were called. He was caught at Birmingham, but no gun was found. And, my lord, the Guardian newspaper that I mentioned ran the headline, AIDS victim is gold for 7 years. Now, the Guardian report much of the same, except they quote Hugh as having a, quote, glittering career, and go on to report, Judge William Allardyce told Rees, quote, I am satisfied that the issue of AIDS has nothing to do with the sentence I impose. If you are to be treated differently, it seems to me it is for the Home Office or Parliament to decide otherwise, end quote. The court heard that Rees had worked for the United Nations in the United States. There, said Mr. Frank Chapman, defending, Rees contracted AIDS from his homosexual lover, whom he nursed for 6 months before his death. Rees then returned to England, where it was confirmed he had the disease.
Mr. Hampson, did the party concerned submit an appeal?
Yes, my lord, they did. Now, I don't have the appeal in front of me, but the press reported on the outcome of this appeal in August the following year, the 10th of August 1988, to be exact. The day following his appeal in the High Court London, the Daily Telegraph, under the headline, Mercy cut in jail sentence for AIDS victim, and they reported, Mercy was shown towards a prisoner facing death from AIDS yesterday when he had a 7-year sentence for robbery cut to 4 years by the Court of Appeal in London, even though the law makes no allowance for special consideration for terminally ill offenders. Mr. Justice French said it was, quote, not impossible, end quote, that the incidence of prisoners suffering from the AIDS virus might be of such frequency that special sentencing measures might have to be introduced. The judge, sitting with Mr. Justice Farquharson, was commenting on the case of Hugh Mark Rees, 30, who pleaded guilty at Stafford Crown Court on December the 19th, last year, to robbing a Wolverhampton sub postmistress of £3,000. Mr. Justice French said Rees of Dale Court, Tentington Hall Road, Wolverhampton, told police he had needed the cash to buy enough heroin to take his own life. The case was complicated by the fact that Rees was a pathological liar who also suffered from Munchausen syndrome, the emulation and simulation of diseases. But tests on Rees had revealed the HIV virus beyond the dormant stage. Doctors estimated his life expectancy at no more than 3 years. Mr. Justice French said Judge Allardyce commented at the Crown Court that it was not for him to alter sentencing policy and he refused to treat Rees differently from any other offender. The Court of Appeal had sympathy for that view, but the court would not shrink from substituting a sentence that would give Rees a measure of hope and improve his lot, said Mr. Justice French. Mr. Frank Chapman, counsel for Rees, had urged that 7 years was a harsh sentence for a terminally ill man. Quote, he has to have the hope of serving his sentence before he dies, end quote. With remission, Rees can expect to be freed after serving 2/3 of his sentence or earlier if granted parole. Last night, the robbery victim, Mrs. Balbir Kumar, 24, criticised the Court of Appeal's decision to cut the sentence. Mrs. Kumar, who was working at the Chapel Ash Sub Post Office, Wolverhampton, when the robbery happened and has now transferred to a post office in Whetstone, North London, said, quote, of course I sympathise over his illness, but he should not have his sentence cut just because of it. He should have got life for what he did to me. I shall never forget the day he came into the shop and threatened to shoot me if I didn't hand over the money. I was really scared and had to take a month off work afterwards. It was doubly frightening because it just happened after the Hungerford massacre, end quote. Mr. Nicholas Partridge of the Terence Higgins Trust, the AIDS charity, said the issue of special sentencing for anyone with a terminal illness needed to be reviewed. Quote, the facilities that are available for coping with terminally ill patients in prisons is limited. It is a difficult area because victims of crime have a right to see that justice is done. There is a need to balance these issues. And, my lord, while Hugh Rees would have welcomed a reduction in his sentence by 3 years given he is still required to serve a third of the 4 years for his crime, it didn't go down well with others who, like the victim, voiced their dismay. As many newspapers ran the story of the sentence being reduced upon appeal on the 11th of August 1988, many also ran the story, like that of the Black Country Evening Mail, who ran the headline, Aids Mercy Storm, with the strapline, "Cut in dying robber's jail term angers Tory." And the article reads, "A cut in a jail sentence for an armed black country robber dying of AIDS has been condemned as a, quote, travesty, end quote. In the Court of Appeal yesterday, Mr. Justice French reduced Hugh Mark Rees's 7-year sentence to 4 years after hearing that he was not expected to live more than 3 years. He said the law at present made no allowance for special consideration to be given to terminally ill offenders and suggested new sentencing measures might have to be introduced for AIDS sufferers. But Sir Gerard Vaughan, a consultant doctor and a former Tory health minister, denounced the move as, quote, illogical, emotional, and a total travesty of justice," end quote, and said he had protested to the Lord Chancellor, quote, "The fact that the person is ill is a matter for hospital facilities within the prison service, but it is a total and absolute travesty of justice to say that somebody is going to get out of a sentence because he is unwell," end quote, he said. And my lord, into the previous article that alluded to the shotgun and how Hugh Rees decided to plead, this article just goes on to add some clarity in regards to the gun, where it states, Rees, who told police he threw a sawn-off shotgun from a London-bound train after the robbery, waived his right to attend yesterday's appeal hearing. And my lord, this is where this story within these newspaper articles comes to an end. And Hugh didn't appear in any other articles after his appeal, not that I could find anyway. However, I did come across and obtain his death certificate. Hugh Mark Rees was born in Leeds on the 12th of July 1958 to Welsh-born parents James Rees and Faye Thomas. While Hugh did have siblings, the families moved back to Wales and his mother's remarriage in 1982 to Colin Davis complicated my search, given that 3 distinctly Welsh surnames are involved, although I did find that his mother, Faye, had passed away in 2019. And it was his mother, Faye Davis, who registered her son's death after he passed away on the 28th of February 2001 at the Sue Ryder Hospice, Leckhampton Court in Gloucestershire, a Grade 2 listed 14th century manor house that, despite the circumstances, offers a visually stunning environment. It indeed would be a desirable place for hospice care. Hugh's cause of death was recorded as Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, better known by its acronym, AIDS. And despite the introduction of antiretroviral treatments in 1996, the continued loss of life due to AIDS into the 2000s remains perplexing. Interestingly, the absence of further mentions of Hugh in the press post-appeal might indicate the significance of his listed occupation upon his death certificate, which stated medical student, and where he resided at the Coach House, Brunswick Square, Gloucester. Initially described by a newspaper as a, quote, Cambridge genius, Hugh graduated from Cambridge University, became employed with the United Nations, and held a position in the United States. Hugh's life, marked by profound challenges and tragedies, experienced a significant shift after his own AIDS diagnosis, prompting a journey of reclamation. Having cared for his partner in America during the harrowing ordeal of the illness, Hugh no doubt witnessed immense struggle and loss, but likely drew from those experiences a deep determination to instigate positive change. At the time of his passing in 2001, he was a medical student, suggesting that his path may have been driven by a desire to foster empathy and support for others enduring similar hardships. His remarkable achievements can be viewed not merely as milestones, but as strides towards understanding his diagnosis, healing, and advocacy, perhaps reflecting a steadfast commitment to transforming personal grief into a catalyst for good. It is profoundly tragic that AIDS claimed Hugh before he had the chance to realise fully the impact he could have had on the lives of many.
A sad and most interesting set of circumstances. Mr. Hampson, I believe you have another series of articles you wish to bring before the listeners?
I do, my lord, because this next case is a act, while wrong, was always weaponised to the maximum and no less stigmatised to the hilt by the British press. But the initial report was a small piece on the 18th of December 1993 in the Lincolnshire Echo with the headline, "Unlawful Wounding Charge Admitted," and it reads, "A man accused of biting a pub landlord admitted a charge of unlawful wounding when he appeared before Lincoln Crown Court. James Moore, 37, of Wollaston Crescent, Ermine East, Lincoln, pleaded guilty to wounding Wayne Hobbs, the licensee of the Prince of Wales, on July the 9th. Moore also admitted assaulting Sharon Whitworth on the same day, causing her actual bodily harm. Sentence was adjourned for probation, psychiatric and medical reports, and Moore was remanded in custody. And, my lord, a few weeks later, the newspaper learns that James Moore is living with AIDS, and on the 14th of January 1994, the Lincolnshire Echo, on their front page, ran the headline, "My AIDS Bite Fear," with the strapline, "Landlord Waits for Tests," where the article states, "A pub landlord faces a week of torment after being bitten by a berserk AIDS victim. Wayne Hobbs has been told by doctors they are 99% sure that he has not been infected with HIV or AIDS, but he will not know for certain until final tests. As his attacker today began a 6-year jail sentence, Mr. Hobbs, 37, who runs the Prince of Wales in Lincoln's Bailgate, told how his life had been wrecked by the horrifying ordeal. Quote, "The strain has been very bad on my family life and on the business. My sex life has gone out the window for the last 6 months, and I have found some people have treated me differently since all this happened. Some people even stopped coming into the pub. I was upfront with people from the start about what happened, but I suppose I cannot really blame them for their reaction. Hopefully, it's now worked out that I haven't got the disease, but it's going to take a long time to get my life back to normal. It was really frightening. The doctors have told me I'm almost certainly clear, but I have still got one more test to go on Monday. Then I've got a week to wait before the final result." End quote. Mr. Hobbs said he had suffered from bouts of depression since the attack last summer, and his health has been affected by the drugs prescribed to him. Quote, "The man who did this isn't right in the head. People like him should not be allowed out on the streets." End quote. Jailing James Moore, 37, of Rolleston Close, Ermine Estate, Lincoln, Judge Dudley Bennett told him he was satisfied the intention of the attack was to transmit the disease. Quote, "I am sure that at the time of the incident, your intention was to pass on some of the frustration you feel by passing on the disease you have." End quote. Mr. Jonathan D., prosecuting, told Lincoln Crown Court the attack happened after staff asked Moore to leave the Prince of Wales. He became abusive and dug his nails into the landlady's hands and screamed that he had AIDS. Then he began threatening customers. When landlord Wayne Hobbs tried to intervene, Moore went berserk and sunk his teeth into his hand. Mr. Hobbs had to undergo intensive hospital treatment after the attack, but doctors are now 99% sure that he has not been infected with HIV or AIDS. Moore pleaded guilty to assault and unlawful wounding. In mitigation, Mr. John Deave said the chance of transmitting the disease through a bite was remote. He said Moore had suffered from depression since the onset of the disease and felt he had been rejected by society. Judge Bennett told him, quote, "No one can be unsympathetic to the fear, the worry, and the rejection that this disease brings. However, my first duty is to protect the public, and you are dangerous because when you drink, you try to inflict your suffering on others." End quote. Mr. Hobbs has now put the pub lease up for sale, partly as a result of his ordeal. And there is a photograph on the front page beside the article of the landlord, Mr. Hobbs, standing at the bar resting on a beer pump. Whether James Moore was advised to or recognised himself his crime, he did plead guilty because what he did was wrong. And, my lord, a little under 2 weeks later, the same landlord was back in the Lincolnshire Echo where, on the 27th of January 1994, they ran the headline, "AIDS scare landlord gets health all clear," with the strapline, "Misery at an end," and the article states, "A pub landlord bitten by a berserk AIDS sufferer is celebrating today after he was told he does not have the disease. Father of two, Wayne Hobbs, was attacked by the man in July when he tried to stop him from threatening customers at his Lincoln pub. He was bitten on the hand and did not know whether he had contracted AIDS until doctors gave him the all clear, putting an end to months of misery. He said, quote, "It's a big relief. I had an inkling that I didn't have it after the first test, but this is confirmation. I'm going to have a drink tonight. One customer has promised me a bottle of champagne. The lads at the pub have been brilliant. They have helped me along and kept me laughing. If you let it get to you, you would go potty," he said. Mr. Hobbs' attacker, James Moore, 37, of Rolleston Close, Ermine, Lincoln, was jailed earlier this month for 6 years. But Mr. Hobbs thought this was not enough. Quote, "I do not think he should be allowed to walk the streets again because if he has done this to me, he might do it to somebody else. he said. Mr. Hobbs, 37, said the attack had made him depressed and he had become wary of strangers. While Mr. Hobbs was waiting for the results, doctors put him on a drug which could have retarded the onset of AIDS if he had contracted it. He praised staff at Lincoln County Hospital and the AIDS counsellors who have helped him through the six-month ordeal. His wife, Laura, 35, said they now had to get on with their lives, but the last 6 months had been, quote, hell. We tried to keep the subject away from the children, but we had to be honest with them, she said. Mr. Hobbs said the whole incident had hit him financially, quote, I have had to pay somebody to do my job because I have been ill with depression from the attack. The solicitors have applied to the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board, but it could take 2 years to get anything, he said. My lord, while I am certain that Mr. Hobbs's experience wasn't a pleasant experience, and even the perpetrator himself, James Moore, pleaded guilty, which surely is an admission that what he did was wrong. Given the article of the 27th of January concludes that Mr. Hobbs's solicitor is applying for a payout for Mr. Hobbs via the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board, I cannot help but feel that these articles are perhaps motivated to serve to influence a compensation payout with the Criminal Injuries Board. I only say this as under 3 months later, the same photo of Mr. Hobbs appears again in the Lincolnshire Echo under the headline, New Ordeals for AIDS Bite Landlord, where the newspaper reports on the 11th of April 1994, a Lincoln landlord bitten by a, quote, berserk, end quote, is now facing ruin. Wayne Hobbs has left his, quote, dream, end quote, pub after a prospective buyer backed out at the last minute. Mr. Hobbs can no longer afford to run the Prince of Wales on Bailgate and expects to be declared bankrupt next week. It has been a terrible year for Mr. Hobbs. First, he had to go through months of misery after the attack, waiting for test results to see whether he had AIDS before he eventually got the all clear. Then Grand Metropolitan Estates took over the pub from John Smith's and Mr. Hobbs faced a higher rent. Life has been hell after the AIDS attack and at the time Mr. Hobbs said the incident had hit him financially after he took time off because of depression.
Mr. Hampson, did the party concerned submit an appeal?
Yes, my lord, those representing James Moore do submit an appeal and the appeal is heard just over 2 months later. Now, similar to the previous case, I don't have access to the appeal itself, but it was widely reported in the press, including the Lincolnshire Echo. And again, with the same photograph of Mr. Hobbs standing behind the bar, resting on the beer pumps, the headline reads, Disgust over AIDS attacker court decision. And the article states, AIDS attack victim Wayne Hobbs today spoke of his disgust after appeal court judges slashed the sentence by almost half of the man who assaulted him. Former pub landlord Mr. Hobbs went through months of misery waiting for HIV test results after being bitten on the hand by former alcoholic James Moore. The court's decision means Moore, 37, can now be considered by the Home Secretary for early release on licence. Stunned, Mr. Hobbs told the Echo, quote, It's disgusting. I'm very angry. He's the last person I want to see running around on the streets, end quote. The court heard how Moore bit Mr. Hobbs and tried to scratch his wife, claiming he had, quote, full-blown AIDS, end quote, at the Prince of Wales pub in Lincoln's Bailgate. Earlier, Moore had been tackled by customers after he grabbed waitress Sharon Whitworth's hand and bent it back, causing her great pain. Mr. Hobbs said he was afraid that if Moore was released, other attacks might follow. He said, quote, I don't think he should be allowed out. Clearly the man is unstable and having done it before, what's to stop him doing it again? Moore was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment for causing actual bodily harm to Miss Whitworth and 4 years consecutive for wounding Mr. Hobbs. Mrs. Justice Smith, Lord Justice Roche and Mr. Justice Potter said, fortunately Mr. Hobbs had suffered no lasting ill effects but had been put through a lot of anxiety. The judges decided to make the two sentences concurrent and cut the assault charge on Miss Whitworth to 6 months, leaving a total of 3.5 years. Mrs. Justice Smith said this was, quote, purely and simply, end quote, so that Mr. Moore could be considered for release on licence. Mr. Hobbs said he had lost his pub and had been declared bankrupt since the attack and was now looking for a job. A report by a prison doctor said it was not known how long Moore had to live. And in the newspapers, there was never any follow-up or mention of any compensation awarded to Mr. Hobbs. I mean, I hope he received something. He certainly was due some form of compensation, and I hope through his endeavours he received the maximum amount available. But in 1994 to 1995, it was well understood, even with the public, the timeline of an AIDS diagnosis. And this was confirmed as 7 months after that article, James Michael Moore sadly passed away on the 8th of February 1995, aged only 38 years old, at the Royal Infirmary, Sunderland. And in trying to find out more about James Moore and his life before his HIV diagnosis and this bite incident appearing in the newspaper, all I could establish was that he was born in Scarborough on the 10th of July 1956 to parents John T. Moore and Annie Kilburn. James was one of four children, with eldest sister Josephine and eldest brother John, followed by little sister Julia. I did also find that almost 3 months to the day of the bite incident, where James was drowning his sorrows by his own admission in the Prince of Wales pub, that on the 8th of April 1993, James appeared in court, of which was listed and mentioned in the Lincolnshire Echo, where it was reported on the 1st of May 1993, James Michael Moore, 37, no fixed abode, theft of a cash box belonging to St Hugh's Roman Catholic Church, compensation £10, 3 counts of breach of conditional discharge, no action taken. And my lord, while I'm not condoning crime or excusing James's actions here, because he's with HIV/AIDS diagnosis and he himself is recognising his actions by pleading guilty, but it makes me wonder if these two incidents are perhaps out of character for James, given I couldn't find any prior or after, and are a result of his HIV/AIDS diagnosis, which at the time was still a guaranteed death sentence in 1995. And, as we heard, he did have depression around his diagnosis, where he said he felt rejected by society. However, at the end of his sentence and upon leaving prison, his death certificate indicates he had secured a masonette on the seemingly very respectable Torrens Road in Sunderland. His occupation is listed as hotel general worker. While this might have been his previous trade, it is perhaps more plausible that this role, hotel general worker, was perhaps arranged for him post-incarceration, given his criminal record and the difficulty he may have had acquiring work. James's cause of death is stated as 1A, acquired immunodeficiency, 1B, human immunodeficiency virus infection. It raises questions as to why both terms are used. While I lack medical expertise, it seems redundant to classify it in that manner. Surely it's one or the other. And additionally, my lord, James's death was registered by Mr. David Schoon, noted in the qualification section as to, quote, causing the body to be buried, end quote. This wasn't unusual, given it would suggest a sense of urgency, perhaps a desire for a quick burial or cremation due to the fears of contagion even in 1995, as well as the reality of overcrowded mortuaries where authorities often cannot afford to store bodies for extended periods if relatives are unreachable. And David Schoon, my lord, has long been a pivotal figure within Sunderland's gay community, engaging in various initiatives that have significantly shaped the local gay landscape. He has been instrumental for many years in establishing Gay Pride in Sunderland, providing essential gay advice services over decades, and securing hostel accommodation for homeless gay men. His commitment to advocating for the community became especially pronounced during the AIDS pandemic of the 1980s and 90s, where he offered invaluable support and resources to those affected. Despite registering the death of James in February 1995, it is important to note that this action does not indicate James's sexual orientation, as it remains undisclosed. At the time James passed away, David Schoon was the project manager and spokesman for Wear Body Positive, an organisation dedicated to providing support, advice and counselling to individuals impacted by AIDS. David's connection to James could range from being his support worker to merely assisting the authorities in the death registration process. While I have located David Schoon and have reached out, I'm yet to hear a response, and attempts to track down James's three siblings have been unfruitful. The pursuit, though, of connections continues, as friends and family often reach out following the airing of these episodes, reflecting our enduring commitment to uncovering the real stories of real lives.
Mr. Hampson, I believe you have another series of articles you wish to bring before the listeners?
Indeed, my lord, because this final set of newspaper articles centre around a 22-year-old young man named John Morgan, who first appears in Bristol's Western Daily Press on the 10th of April 1986, under the headline, Warders Get Space Suits to Handle AIDS Prisoner. And the article states, prison officers in Bristol are to be issued with protective masks and, in quotation, space suits to handle an AIDS carrier. John Morgan, a 22-year-old who carries the virus, is due to appear before Bristol magistrates on Tuesday for sentencing. A spokesman for the Prison Officers Association at Horfield Prison, Bristol, said free barrier suits had been offered to officers worried about contact with AIDS victims. Prison Officer Association officials will meet the prison governor to discuss the AIDS problem. The spokesman said, quote, "We are aware of the situation and we will be talking to our members about it and obviously explaining the situation," end quote. Morgan has been remanded to Bristol Magistrates by Plymouth Magistrates Court, where he admitted one theft charge and three driving offences. He is accused of other offences in Bristol. Two earlier hearings at Plymouth were missed because Exeter prison officers refused to escort him. The charges were finally heard after the officers did agree to accompany him and declined the offer of protective clothing. But Morgan stood alone in the dock with a single police officer 6 feet away. And, my lord, the same story appears in the Evening Post the following day, the 11th of April, 1986, under the headline, Prison in AIDS Alert. Then, my lord, Tuesday comes and John Morgan appears at Bristol Magistrates Court, where the Western Daily Press report on his appearance the day after, on Wednesday, the 16th of April, 1986, under the headline, Court Sprayed After AIDS Man, 23, Is in Dock. And the article states, officials ordered a Bristol magistrate's court to be clinically cleaned yesterday after an AIDS victim appeared in the dock. All areas which drug addict John Morgan, age 23, had touched during the hour-long hearing were sprayed afterwards. Morgan, unemployed of Clifton Place, Bristol, was jailed for 24 months after admitting 9 counts of stealing from cars, absconding and drugs offences. Mr. Roger Gibbs, defending, told the court that Morgan had the hepatitis B virus in his blood and was an AIDS carrier. He said all the offences were drugs related and his client seemed to be on a slippery slope. Morgan was escorted to the court from Exeter Prison by warders wearing special protective suits. He was kept in isolation in the cells before his appearance in court number 8, where he was guarded in the dock by a policeman in normal uniform. Proceedings were delayed for 3 minutes after his appearance while the court was cleaned and an official used an aerosol spray called Astelic D to clean the dock and other parts which Morgan had touched. A court official said the exercise, the first of its kind in the court's history, was a safeguard to calm anxieties of other people using the building. Two earlier hearings involving Morgan at Plymouth were stopped when Exeter prison officers refused to escort him. Last night, Dr. Ian Baker, District Medical Officer for Bristol and Western Health District, said, quote, "In the normal course of events, a person going to court who just happens to be positive for AIDS is not putting other people at risk," end quote. The courtroom spraying would not have achieved much, he added. And if you, my lord, like me and I suspect those listening, think regardless of John Morgan's crimes that his treatment around his HIV/AIDS diagnosis and so publicly was a massive overreaction even for 1986. Well, 2 days later doctors in Bristol call it out where the Evening Post on the 18th of April 1986 run the headline Doctors Accuse Court Bigots with the strapline Row Over AIDS Man where the article states doctors in Bristol have accused officials at the city's magistrates court of bigotry and ignorance in their handling of the case of an AIDS carrier who appeared for sentence. The condemnation comes after the court was cleared on Tuesday and the dock sprayed with disinfectant following the appearance of the 23-year-old AIDS carrier. Dr. Alfred Room and Dr. Evan Cole, virologists at the Public Health Laboratory in Bristol, have called the action unnecessary. Quote, "We know of no case where a person in their situation has infected others," end quote, said Dr. Room. He said that AIDS could only be caught through the blood or by sexual contact. Quote, "This demonstrates the ignorance and bigotry about AIDS in our community," end quote. He said the safety measures were not necessary as a precaution against hepatitis, which the AIDS carrier also suffered from. A court official would not comment. Then, my lord, 10 months later, in February 1987, John Morgan is back in the press, where the Liverpool Echo, where John was originally from but is now living in Bristol, ran the headline on the 26th of February 1987, "I'm having Merseyside man's baby," and the article states, "A 21-year-old mother-to-be today admitted she deliberately became pregnant, although she knew her Merseyside-born lover had AIDS. Tomorrow, tests will reveal whether she and her unborn baby have contracted the disease. The woman, who calls herself Heather Morgan, says she is prepared to die with her 24-year-old common-law husband, John Morgan, from Hamilton Road, Wallasey. Slim, black-haired Heather, who is 2 months pregnant, told of her decision at the squat in St Paul's, Bristol, where she lives. She said, quote, "I knew my husband was an AIDS carrier, but I think the world of him and I want children. I was delighted when the pregnancy test was positive. I want children and it was my decision to get pregnant, not an accident. I'd rather die with my husband and child than not have children," end quote. John Morgan caught AIDS from a dirty hypodermic needle and is now on remand in custody for a theft offence. He was a drug addict when he left Wallasey 5 years ago at 19. The couple have lived together for the past 4 years. Heather, a former art student, visits him every day and this week broke the news to him that she was pregnant. She said, quote, "He's really pleased that he's going to be a father, but he's sick and can't look after me. When we first found out he was a carrier, we started using a condom for a while, but I think the world of him and I'd rather die with him. I've wondered for a while if I was pregnant. Last week I got one of those testing kits and that was positive. Then the doctor confirmed it. My mum doesn't like me living in a squat really and I'm trying to get somewhere else to live now that I've got the baby to think about. I told my parents I'm pregnant and there is a possibility that I'm carrying AIDS and they were very supportive. They are beautiful. So long as I'm happy, then they are happy," end quote. Officials involved in John Morgan's case say he first knew of the pregnancy at his Bristol Magistrates Court appearance on Monday. They said he, quote, "cried tears of joy," end quote. It is understood that Heather is also a heroin addict and the couple would probably cross-infect each other from sharing needles as well as through sexual activity. Mr. Morgan's mother, Audrey, said at her home this afternoon, quote, "I know they have wanted a baby for years. They have stuck together through thick and thin. They have been very close," end quote. She said that in his last letter, her son said he had been released from prison isolation and given a job. She added, quote, "I presumed he must be okay for him to be allowed to mix with other prisoners. I presumed he was given the all clear and I think he thought the same," end quote. A health department spokesman said, quote, "Our concern would be that the woman and her family were fully counselled and advised of the effect of any actions they took. Our advice to women with AIDS-infected partners would be not to become pregnant because there is an increased risk to both mother and baby. A woman who becomes infected has a 50-50 chance of passing it on to her child." And my lord, that story rumbles on for days in newspapers up and down the country. Then, we are given an update on the 28th of February 1987, where the Western Daily Press ran the headline, "AIDS all clear for mother-to-be," where they report, "Pregnant squatter Heather Morgan was told yesterday that she and the baby she is carrying are free from the AIDS virus. Heather, age 21, deliberately got pregnant though she knew her common-law husband, a heroin addict, has AIDS. Earlier, doctors and health chiefs criticised Heather's decision. John Morgan, 24, is on remand at Horfield Prison, charged with going equipped for theft. He caught AIDS from a dirty needle." Then, my lord, on the 3rd of March 1987, the Western Daily Press ran the headline, "Jail Isolation Ordeal of AIDS Victim," where the article states, "AIDS carrier John Morgan was suffering more than most prisoners on remand," his solicitor claimed yesterday. Morgan, age 24, whose girlfriend recently discovered she was pregnant, was refused bail when he faced Bristol magistrates charged with interfering with vehicles and going equipped for theft. His solicitor, Mr. Terry Allen, said Morgan, who was remanded until March the 13th, was being kept in isolation in a prison hospital wing, and, he said, his client was desperate to be with his girlfriend. Morgan's common-law wife, Heather, 21, has been told by doctors that neither she nor the baby have the AIDS virus. The couple used to live in a squat in City Road, St Paul's, Bristol, but Ms. Morgan has now found a new home following publicity surrounding the case. Last night, Mr. Ronald Speakman, chairman of the Bristol branch of the Prison Officers Association, said, quote, "We're not happy about having anyone with AIDS in the prison, but at least he is in isolation. Then, my lord, all goes quiet for 3 years in the press. Until the Western Daily Press on the 7th of March 1990 ran the headline, Jail for AIDS Sufferer Who Bit Policeman in Drugs Raid. And the article states, AIDS-infected drug user John Morgan has been jailed after biting a detective during a CID raid. Bristol magistrates jailed Morgan, aged 27, for 6 months for drugs offences, assault and obstruction. For the policeman, it could be 10 years before he knows whether he has contracted the AIDS virus. Oh, God, what bullshit. The court heard that officers raiding a house in Albert Park Place, St. Paul's, Bristol, in January, were confronted by Morgan wielding a broken beer glass. As two officers handcuffed him, there was a scuffle, and one of them was bitten on the hand and cut with the glass. The bite broke the detective's skin, putting him at risk of contracting the killer disease. Morgan was charged with obstructing police, possessing the banned drugs, diamorphine, fisepton, and cannabis resin, and assault, occasioning actual bodily harm. He pleaded not guilty, but was convicted and sentenced to 6 months on each charge to run concurrently. The officer showed no signs of contracting AIDS, but the magistrate asked for his name not to be published because of the stigma of the disease. Detective Chief Inspector Dave Warren said experts put the policeman's chances of contracting AIDS at 4 or 5 million to 1. Quote, "There is a chance, however slight, and that's something we will have to live with for a long time," end quote, he said. A doctor of virology warned that victims who knowingly pass on AIDS could be charged with murder. My lord, I'm sure yourself and anybody listening, perhaps like me, is bemused and concerned that anonymity can be given to the police officer who hasn't got the disease but runs this alleged risk that he could have contracted it. But there's never any consideration in regards to the stigma of sharing publicly the names of the individuals as they have done here with John Morgan, with many of the headlines that we've read. It's just bizarre. Anyhow, my lord, off the back of that article, it is perhaps evident that John has made no genuine effort to redirect the course of his life, persistently entangled in a web of drugs and crime, it seems. Even the presence of his common law wife and the responsibility of a child perhaps seemingly failed to inspire any significant change in his behaviour. And, my lord, it's not for me or any of the listeners to judge. He's quite entitled to live his life as he pleases. And then, in May 1991, my lord, he received 18 months probation for interfering with a vehicle, driving while disqualified, and driving without insurance, nor due care and attention, damaging two glass panels and theft of a radio cassette player, and as a result, was banned from driving for 1 year. Then, in October the same year, 1991, another 18 months probation for theft of a radio cassette player, keys and damaging a door, theft of two speakers and two offences of failing to surrender to custody and possession of cannabis. Then 3 years later in May 1994, he received a conditional discharge for 1 year for interfering with a vehicle and carrying an offensive weapon. And, my lord, as we've just heard from the many articles that I've read, Bristol was consistent in reporting court proceedings like those that we've heard. However, in regards to John Morgan and the newspaper archives, all went quiet. I therefore thought, perhaps, John had moved out of the area, but a search didn't yield any results. Maybe he'd turned his life around. But I was also aware, since that first press report of his HIV/AIDS diagnosis, he was now approaching 9 years with the virus. On average, and it is only an average, people with HIV untreated live for around 8 to 10 years before succumbing to AIDS-related complications, unless another cause of death or misadventure is confirmed. So, I started to check the death records and found nothing. But I then stumbled across an article in the Bristol Post on the 20th of June 2019 with the headline, "Jail for a man who subjected bus station security officer to the N-word 50 times. And the article states, "A Bristol bus station security officer was subjected to a, quote, vile racist rant, end quote, when he tried to move a man on. Libban Moose tried to move John Morgan from a turnstile outside the ladies' lavatory, Bristol Crown Court heard. Instead of complying, Morgan lit up a cigarette, took a swig of alcohol, and blasted the N-word at him some 50 times. He continued the rant when police arrived and attempted to bite one of the officers. Morgan, 56, of Long Hills Hostel in Whitefield Road, Bristol, pleaded guilty to causing racially aggravated alarm or distress, assaulting an emergency worker, possessing cannabis, possessing a knife, and causing criminal damage. Judge Julian Lambert jailed him for 26 months. He told Morgan, quote, "This was yet another vile, racist rant by you involving repeated, foul language against a man trying to serve the public. It was completely and utterly unacceptable." Grace Flynn, prosecuting, said Morgan bombarded Mr. Moose with abuse and threatened police, saying he had AIDS. Miss Flynn said, quote, "He was verbally and physically aggressive. He opened his mouth and twice attempted to bite an officer on his arm. There was no successful bite." The defendant was removed from the scene. He had something in his mouth and had a small cut on his forehead. Morgan was taken to Bristol Royal Infirmary for a medical check and continued racial abuse, the court heard. Later, in the back of a police van, he fell asleep and a bag containing 6.9 grams of cannabis fell out of his mouth. The court heard that, just a few weeks later, Morgan was seen near his hostel scratching a car with a large kitchen knife. He was arrested and made a statement saying he had been drinking and had the knife because he didn't want it to be stolen. Christopher Pembridge, defending, said his client had had a very difficult life, with periods of homelessness. Mr. Pembridge said Morgan had not gone out of his way to abuse Mr. Moose and had not succeeded in biting police. Oh, appalling behaviour, my lord. But what I find interesting is that for all James's petty crimes and his drug habit, James is clearly engaging in HIV treatments and adhering to HIV medications to have successfully lived for as long as he has since his HIV diagnosis in the mid-1980s that we got to hear about in those newspaper articles. Now, it's not for us to judge James, but it is a shame that James hasn't been able to turn his life around in other ways as he has in regards to his personal health, receiving a diagnosis that was at the time a death sentence to now living successfully with treatment. And in contrast, I looked up Heather, and regardless of the veracity or if there was any truth to the reports surrounding her in those newspaper articles, she has, it seems, gone on to establish a professional career and, just like you and I, is enjoying life. This divergence in their paths highlights not just only the choices they have made, but also the broader spectrum of resilience and circumstance that shapes individual experiences. While James's life illustrates the struggle against societal and personal barriers, Heather's success serves as a reminder of the potential for recovery and transformation, reflecting the varied ways in which people navigate their challenges. And that, my lord, concludes this episode.
Mr. Hampson presented a series of poignant cases today, illustrating the complex interplay between victimhood and culpability. While it is crucial to acknowledge the moral and legal violations that have occurred, we must also consider the profound impact of an HIV or AIDS diagnosis. Such a condition, undeniably cruel in its nature, cannot serve as a justification for criminal actions. However, it undoubtedly shapes the narrative surrounding each individual. Each case serves as a stark reminder that beneath the offences, there existed a life, one that preceded the incidents we have just heard. And for many, these lives are now but memories, tragically cut short. In reflecting on these stories, we are compelled to recognise the humanity of those involved and the heavy burdens they carried, reinforcing the importance of empathy in our discussions of justice and morality. This podcast is adjourned until next week.
Court rise!
You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.